Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello everyone, welcome to a very special Roker Report preview as we build up to our next league game against Swindon Town at the Energy Check County Ground. We are very lucky to be joined today by a man who played a part in breaking Sunderland fans' hearts at Wembley 30 years ago as a player and is now currently the academy manager at Swindon Town. We are delighted to be joined by Alan McLaughlin. Hi Alan.
Hiya, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. I imagine you're as pleased as everyone else that football has managed to get going again.
Well, I am because it's obviously a big void in our lives, isn't it? It plays a huge part socially, mentally as well. People getting ready for Saturday, chatting about their sides, etc. The one thing we need now is obviously fans in stadiums, and that's fairly obvious, whether it be the Stadium of Light, whether it be the County Ground, whether it be Fratton Park. We need fans in the stadium in a sensible way, which I'm sure can be organised. Clubs can organise various things and go through various processes, and it should be something that should be relatively easy to do. But we're dealing with a government, unfortunately, that is not doing things quite so easy and making things a little bit difficult at the time. So football's there. I watch it on TV. Unfortunately, I don't get the same buzz. I'm not feeling it.
It's not the same.
It's not the same. No, you sit there and you end up going to your phone and you end up, changing channels because you just don't feel the energy from the fans. And, you know, and I don't think anyone realised the impact would be quite as severe, really, on how you perceive and watch a game. So, yeah, quite interesting as well.
Yeah. Just before we get right into it and get into the kind of relevant stuff, I suppose, while I was doing some prep, I came across the same fact a couple of times and thought I'd double check with you before we get into it. You're originally from Manchester and grew up around the main road area, around the stadium, the old stadium, which is a ground I used to love to visit, although it did get a bit hairy now and again on the way
sure
to the ground when I was a young lad. But yeah, but I read that you're in the same class at school as a certain Noel Gallagher. Was that true?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, the first 2/3 years at secondary school, we were in the same class. And then I moved up I'm not sure why, I was hoofed out of one class and I moved up a couple of classes. And the last 2 years we weren't in the same class. But we did go to Man City together. I did tag, even though I was a United fan, I wasn't letting my mates really know. I just wanted to go and watch a game. Plus I live right by the ground as well. So it was up to them to make their way to me. And we met. And as you can imagine, the back of the Kippax there, where you were probably corralled, was where I used to, and we used to sneak under at about 3:10, particularly in the early days under the turnstiles. But yeah, that's where I used to watch football because I wasn't allowed to go and watch Man United because it was too far across town. I couldn't go by myself. My dad was working and I literally lived outside the ground, literally in the houses in front of the ground of the old main road. Anyone, and I'm sure there's plenty of Sunderland fans that remember it. I lived on the houses right opposite the ground, so it was easy for me.
I loved going to main road. Was he a decent footballer?
No, he was crap. he probably claims he's decent, but no. But what I would say is we didn't meet each other for years. And I think it was the 98 season and our opening game of the season when I was at Portsmouth was Man City away. And it was a baking hot first day of the season. And I was in the shade, sort of like warming up. And next thing, there's a bit of a commotion. Liam came out first, followed by Noel, made their way down to the Portsmouth fans, giving them grief and stick. And then Noel obviously obviously realised I was playing at Portsmouth at that time, looked around and I spotted him, he spotted me, and he's run over and jumped on me, basically, you know, like jumped on my back. So after that game, there was obviously, after the game, there was a lot of conversation afterwards with the press. We drew 2-2 and most of the press just wanted to know why and what the reaction was. Why was Noel Gallagher jumping on your back? And, you know, I had to tell him, obviously, that I did know him from back in the day, really, although we hadn't spoken maybe 5-6 years at that point because we'd left school and had moved on and he had. But I got offered a significant amount of money, I remember, to spill the beans on him as school, because they were at the height of their fame at that point. I didn't take the bait, though, because it just wasn't worth the hassle, and I didn't want to be seen to be some sort of freeloader who was going to make a few quid out of the situation. I mean, I can do it now if anyone's listening. I'll quite happily do it.
Well, I mean, just obviously getting into your career at Swindon Town, I mean, just to kind of set us up for that 1990, I mean, you joined after being released by Manchester United in 1986, but your career seemed to take off after the appointment of Ozzy Ardiles. I mean, it was his first appointment in football, and he started off as a player manager, so he actually played a couple of games, but he seemed to have a huge impact not only on the club, but you as a player, because you were flying in that first season.
Yeah, it was. And to be fair, I was 19 when I moved down to Swindon. I mean, I didn't even know where Swindon was. And at that point, I didn't even know where Wiltshire was. So to move away from home was difficult at 19. To move to a side that had been promoted as well was difficult. I was one of the younger players in and around the squad. And I was supplementing, really, the team. I think I only made 8 or 9 appearances in my first season and was sent out on loan to Torquay, and literally sent out on loan. There was no, would you mind going, or do you fancy it? No, you're going. See you later. We'll see you in 2 months. And it was probably the best thing that ever happened to me, because obviously by going to Torquay, who were down at the bottom of the old fourth division then, you know, with real men who were at the end of their careers battling away, every penny counted for, every point was important. And it was fantastic, really. And I earned my corn down there, got some goals, played on a regular basis, and it set me up for the next season. But again, at that point, Swindon got promoted again. And they got 2 promotions on the spin. And I joined a squad again who were promoted, and Lou Macari had signed some more players, and I found myself on the periphery again. And it wasn't until about halfway through that season that I got into the side, and that was only just a bit of luck through a couple of injuries. And I played towards, I think, from Christmas to the end of the season, virtually every game. But then Lou got offered the job at West Ham. Off he went. Ozzy came in, and things changed from there. He changed the style of our play. And we were the first side I ever played against who, you know, we played with the diamond formation. Duncan Shearer, Steve White up front with me at the top of the diamond. And it was experimental, but it worked out fantastically well. And, you know, as we grew as a team through the season, our performances got better and stronger. And I remember going and playing at Roker Park, and I think we drew. But we played really well on the day.
Last minute goal, wasn't it?
And I managed to score away. It was actually November. And I'd scored my 10th goal of the season by November. So I was really flying. And I set up Duncan Shearer's second goal of the game to equalise, I think. And we found a formula. We found a group of players that were willing to play for the manager and give everything. And we found a manager that was very happy to engage with us. And like you said, he played a couple of games. And he had a particular stinker at Oldham, and he basically asked us to vote whether he should retire or not, which is quite a strange vote, really. If you imagine it, a World Cup winner standing in front of you asking you to put your hand up whether you think he should retire, and you're thinking, you know, if I put my hand up here, he might drop me for next week. So, but he took it in good spirit, and he decided to manage from the sidelines, and we went on and did quite well that season.
Yeah, well, that brings us perfectly to the end of that 1989-90 season. Like, as I said, I think you'd scored about 15 by the time we got to that end of the season. Sunderland and Swindon both finishing the playoffs. We beat Newcastle in the semi by winning 2-1 at St James's. I think you beat Blackburn 4-2 on aggregate over the two semi-final, second legs. And it's the first ever season that the playoffs finals were held at Wembley over the bank holiday weekend. Can you remember that adding kind of an extra incentive, you know, on top of promotion to kind of get to that final?
I think most of the players were annoyed, really, because it meant the season dragging on to the end of May. If you can imagine, you know, you sort of like, you get through, you've got the playoffs, and then you've got, I think we had a 10-day gap between finishing against Blackburn and then to the, so most of the lads were, is the season ever going to finish? I think we'd played at that point, we'd played about 54 or 55 games at that point. We'd actually played Bolton four times in a cup game, and it took four games and three extra times to settle it. So you can imagine, you know, we were feeling quite fatigued. But I suppose in one way, that little bit of a gap helped us up to the Sunderland game. But no, it didn't really faze us too much. Like I said, we were feeling confident. My great friend, Paul Hardiman, who played for Sunderland, played in that game against Newcastle, and he spoke to me about that in later times. But I mean, whether we were deciding whether we'd sooner play Sunderland, Newcastle, it really didn't matter at that point. The fact of the matter was we were just dying to get to Wembley. As you can imagine, I think probably every player that played that day, apart from a couple, maybe Eric Gates, maybe, I'm just guessing here, Fraser Digby in goal, potentially. I think Dave Kerslake, who was the right back for Swindon, had played at Wembley before, but I think probably, or Bracewell probably would have played there, I would imagine, at some
few times, I think.
Yeah, he would have played. But I'd say 80% of the players hadn't probably played there. So there was a buzz about playing at Wembley and actually going there. And obviously the one thing you don't want to do is come away from Wembley and not win. And we were fortunate enough on the day to pull out a fantastic 1-0 performance. And I can remember the game vividly because of the amount of chances we missed. I know Sunderland started quite brightly. I don't know if you can remember the game too well, or you've seen little bits on the video. Certainly Eric had half a chance where he crossed it instead of maybe having a pop at goal. Marco obviously was a threat down the right-hand side once. But once we'd weathered that early storm, really the game was only going one way. I've counted since about 10 clear-cut chances. And my chance, actually, an opportunity, was the least likely to have gone in the back of the net, because the rest of the chances were what you'd call normal goals that a Duncan Shearer might have scored, a Steve White might have scored, a Steve Foley, our central midfielder, normally stuck away. And we didn't. And it left us sort of like hanging on towards the end of the game, thinking that Sunderland might get something out of it. But we managed to prevail. And it was one of our strong performances of the season, and to do it at Wembley on the day, against a very good Sunderland side, by the way, in terms of experience, a little bit of youth in there, was a great victory. But it all meant nothing, as you know.
Well,
it meant something to Sunderland a bit further down the line. And you certainly, I'm sure the likes of Mr. Ron Atkinson at Sheffield Wednesday, they were absolutely fuming because they felt they should have stayed in the first division and Sunderland should have stayed where they were. So I remember all the furore about that. But the next day, I'd luckily been selected for Ireland and their World Cup squad, and I missed all the celebrations back at Swindon. But like I said, the 50-odd games we played that season all accumulated to nothing, really, after that brilliant performance at Wembley and beating Sunderland, and ended up us being demoted two divisions. But I also remember on the day walking back, because Sunderland had the tunnel end, the fans, and some really gracious Sunderland fans, and I can say this, you know, and I know this for a fact, clapping us, the Swindon players, off the pitch. I think they'd realised their team had took a bit of a battering that day, even though it was 1-0, and graciously clapped us, and, you know, which was, you don't see that very often. So that was great to see.
Yeah, I think when Sunderland fans think about that game, I think the first thing is always the performance of Tony Norman.
Yeah, unbelievable.
He stopped it being a cricket score, yeah.
Fantastic. I mean, I've seen some of the saves, and obviously you reminisce sometimes and it comes up on your timeline, maybe on whatever, and the goal comes up and you get reminded of it every other year. But Tony on that day was fantastic, and he'll be probably as annoyed as anyone else that the goal that beat him took a deflection off Gary's shin pad, which I aimed for, by the way. it was a tactical ploy, I would say. And it come off him and went in the net. Now, I'm pretty sure he probably would have saved the shot going down to his right-hand side. But I think any Sunderland fan that cared to watch the game or was at the game would walked away and gone, we've got to take that one on the chin. We got well and truly battered that day.
Absolutely. It was a roasting hot day. And I think, I mean, because I was only young at that point, but I don't think I'd ever seen a team keep the ball so much and so well, you know, especially kind of in the flesh. I mean, we mentioned earlier about Ardiles, but I mean, was he arguably a bit ahead of his time in that respect? Because not many teams played like that then.
No, I can't think of any, particularly in any of the either League 1, 2, 3 or 4 at the time. He was, and tactically very astute in what he was doing. I mean, I was really surprised. I thought Sunderland on the day might have tried to match us up in some way. The amount of goals we scored that season, I mean, I scored 17, Duncan Shearer got 30, Steve White got 30-odd. So it was a bit of a goal machine team in terms of chances. And at that point then, we were really flowing. And very surprised they played 4-4-2 against us and left me in sort of spaces which I could only dream of, really, to be getting into and causing problems. And again, although the goal was a deflection, I've worked that position, and we worked that position so many times during the season. So from our perspective, we were quite surprised, and obviously it was unique, and Ozzie worked on it. It took a while for us to get used to it, but he was very underrated in terms of tactically how astute he was. And obviously then when he went on to Tottenham, it was a very open team, if you can remember. And it led to them, you know, maybe winning 5-4 or losing 6, you know, losing 3-2, very open games. But that was just the way he liked his teams to play. And, you know, we were certainly the epicenter. You know, we was probably the bit he could get his teeth into to see whether this system could work and he could get the players to play a certain way, and it worked for him. And he did, you know, relay back many times to us about his time in Argentina and playing this sort of way, and that was a natural way of playing for him. So, we eventually got used to it, and we got used to our roles and responsibilities. And like I said, I was quite surprised on the day that even as the game was, the amount of chances that were being created, that Sunderland never changed it at any point to try and disrupt what we were doing. But yeah, it was what it was in the end. And Sunderland benefited from our misfortune in terms of what had gone on financially at the club. But the one thing I need to say now is, and I need Sunderland fans that are listening, and there's hopefully lots of them, I've got it on good authority that the Football League at the time knew of our position prior to the semi-finals. And I think the word is that they decided they would gamble that out of the four teams, Swindon wouldn't be the team that got promoted and they could deal with it. So, so it ended up us going to Wembley. And we didn't get any medals that day.
I don't know
if it's the first time that a team has ever been promoted and no medals given out to any of the players. Because again, I think now if that was Sunderland walking up the steps, maybe the box might have been lifted up and the medals given out because they knew the situation. But I'm looking desperately along thinking, where's my medal? And unfortunately, Swindon never decided to tee us up with a medal either. So it works both ways, but never mind. It's gone now.
I spoke to a few of the Sunderland squad around that time who played in that final, a couple of names that you mentioned there. And they've all said to Owen they knew nothing of the situation and that they didn't think anything was going to kind of come of it. They were just, it was kind of all about the football and who won on the day. I mean, I imagine with the way you played as well, that all the Swindon Town players were in the same boat.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly that. We had no idea what was really going on in the background. I mean, we had no idea on some of the stuff that was going on at the football club. Absolutely no idea of what allegedly was going on. We had received some money during the season. For example, if we played three games, say if we played on a Saturday, Tuesday, Saturday, you know, management would come in and say, right, if you win all three games, you'll all receive £100 bonus each. And we got little incentives like that through the season, but nothing that was huge where you were given thousands of pounds or anything like that. There were just little incentives, or it might be a case of we were playing Sunderland in the league at the county ground in September. They might come in and say £150 for man of the match, £100 for second, £50 for third, as voted by the manager and his staff. And there were little increments like that, which weren't anything to, you know, we didn't think anything of it really. It was a nice little something you put in your pocket. But these things were happening in various clubs at various levels, and certainly above us in the first division, there was lots of things going on, and certainly we were made an example of. But obviously once they started to delve further into the club finances, and again, players didn't understand or realise or weren't told, we just got on with the games on a Saturday or a Tuesday or whatever it was, and we had no idea of what was about to hit us really. And it was a real shock. And like I said, I was away in Italy. luckily, that took my mind off things. And my girlfriend at the time, and my wife now, Debbie, she phoned me to say that we'd been demoted two divisions, and I literally couldn't believe it. And I knew at that point then that the team would be broken up because the club couldn't survive financially. And I ended up being the first player to go. But it wasn't until the December the following season that I actually left for Southampton. And ironically, then, I think we played at Sunderland about three games into my time at Southampton. Yes. I think it was the second home game I played. So, yeah, that was quite ironic.
Yeah, yeah, huge move for about £1 million, wasn't it? Big move, wasn't it, to Southampton?
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, leaving 1990 behind, you nearly crossed paths again with Sunderland in 1992 when you were at Portsmouth. Portsmouth reached the FA Cup semi-final as we did, and you played Liverpool. And as we beat Norwich 1-0 in the other semi-final, you drew with Liverpool after extra time, which meant back then it was a replay, of course, in old money. And after you came agonisingly close to hitting the bar in the last 5 minutes.
Yeah, thanks for reminding me of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Portsmouth end up getting beat off on penalties, especially because you knew Sunderland had already beaten Norwich and were in the final. I mean, that must have been maybe a bigger blow than kind of maybe normal if you were going on to play an Arsenal or a Liverpool or someone else like that in the final.
Well, it was obviously gutted to draw Liverpool in the semi-final. You know, we beat Nottingham Forest in the quarter-final. Yeah, so everyone was trying to avoid Liverpool, just the fact it was Liverpool. But we ended up playing against them. And again, a different game plan to Ozzy, to sit in, contain, counter-attack, and it worked perfectly. And then I got taken off then with about 3 minutes to go, 4 minutes. No, it was about 5 minutes to go before the end of the game. And I was marking Ronnie Whelan. That was my job on the day. And ironically, then there's a free kick. Alan Knight, John Barnes takes it. Alan Knight knocks it onto the post. And who steps up and taps it over the line? Ronnie Whelan. So there's, you know, so that sort of like spoiled that day. But certainly, you know, I think it would have been brilliant, really, for everyone if it had been a Sunderland-Portsmouth final. I think football itself, generally, for it to be a final of two teams who hadn't been there in, you know, however many years, and it would just added been something different rather than your big teams getting to the final. And I think over the two games, we probably deserved it over the two games. I mean, at Highbury particularly, you know, there was chances. I had one saved on the I had a back heel that Ray Houghton knocked off the line. I had a great save from Grobbelaar from a shot I had from a corner, and then Darren went through and scored, and we just didn't hang on. And I mean, we'd have, like Sunderland would have fancied their chances against to play Portsmouth. So we're all fingers crossed, and it didn't quite work out that way. But Sunderland got there, and the rest is history, really. So it was disappointing on the day for him, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was one of those. I always remember that Liverpool Portsmouth semi final. It was one of those old fashioned epic kind of semi finals that you don't really see anymore. But there you go.
Which is a shame.
I mean, another quick game I wanted to mention that, you know, that was against Sunderland this time that you're involved in. And I did apologise in advance. I did think twice about mentioning this one. But it was when you were in the Portsmouth side a year later that visited Roker Park in May 1993.
Yeah.
Portsmouth were 3 points clear of West Ham on your way to the Premier League under Jim Smith. And Sunderland, we'd actually won 1-11 and we were just above the relegation zone. And an utterly, I was there that day, utterly bizarre game. We had two players sent off, two penalties, and won 4-1. But it was completely out of the blue. And you ended up in the playoffs where I think really you should have gained automatic promotion.
That was the game changing game for us. We were flying Portsmouth at the time. Again, Walsh and Whittingham up front. Again, me playing in that position just behind them two. And it worked really well. I mean, Guy Whittingham scored 49 goals that year. Myself and Paul got double figures each that season as well. And we travelled up there really, really confident. And it just went to pot. First of all, Guy Butters got sent off after about, I don't know how many minutes, let's say 25 minutes. Handled a ball, I think Don Goodman had a header that was going in. And Guy Butters then handled it, saved it, straight red. He was off. So we were down to 10 men then, but still within the game. I think it was a penalty, then they scored it. But we still felt confident, creating still chances. And then just before half-time, Paul Walsh gets sent off. And I think Paul went in and redecorated the change rooms at Roker. I think he got in a fair bit of trouble. So we played with 9 men for the second half and got beat. What did you say? It was 3-1, wasn't it? Was it 3-1?
It was 4-1. 4-1 in the end.
And I actually remember Guy Whittingham going through twice when it was we were getting beat, and he had one-on-ones versus, I assume it was Tony in goal, and he missed them both. And looking back now, if he'd have stuck one or both of them away and we'd lost the game, it wouldn't have been the end of the world, because we only missed out on goal difference. So, I mean, you could say that through the whole season, couldn't you, from August, if he'd have scored there or I'd have scored. But two, that was a really significant game, because then it led into the semi, into the playoffs against Leicester, and we were missing Guy Butters and Paul Walsh, more importantly, Paul Walsh. And he was a major factor in us not getting certainly to the final, who eventually was Swindon Leicester in the final. So, yeah, that was probably my most disappointing at club level, because we were such a good team, played really well that season, and missed out. But that was a significant game, and obviously you were there to witness it, and I witnessed it on the pitch, and the two players getting sent off really hurt us, and cost us in the end promotion, unfortunately.
It was sort of bizarre that I think our form was so bad that even with nine men, I think you were giving us a game.
And I'll be honest, even with nine men, we were creating chances. So it wasn't one of the best Sunderland sides that certainly were around at the time. And like that's what I said, that at nine men, two one-on-ones that Guy went through on, and he didn't convert on the day. But I mean, who could have argued with someone not converting after he'd scored 49 that season? He moved on to Aston Villa after that season, not getting up. And we sort of like that team. Unfortunately, they didn't keep the team together, and it broke up really. And things were a bit lean thereafter for a while.
Yeah, I did think about mentioning it, so apologies for that. But I do remember turning up thinking, how many are we going to get turned over by this week? Because I was looking at the stats bizarrely, and our run in that season, we actually we won 3 out of the last 18.
Wow.
And that was one of them, but a completely bizarre game. And I didn't want to leave your playing career behind just before we move on to Swindon Town. You know, 42 caps for the Republic of Ireland and 2 World Cups. And I know you mentioned getting called up to the 1990 squad. That was in strange circumstances. So, I mean, in terms of your experience with the two, was it two completely different experiences because you're at different stages of your international career?
Yeah, definitely. The first time I was called up was literally out of the blue. It was the night before the playoff final against Sunderland. So I was in the hotel. Well, I say it was late afternoon. And Maurice Setters, the assistant to Jack, phoned the hotel and eventually got through to me. And he told me I was in the squad, which I couldn't believe anyway. So, you know, all my birthdays had come in once. I was travelling to Italy. I had no idea around the circumstance of when of that conversation, and when I did get to Italy, that Jack had decided to leave Gary Waddock out of the squad, although he was initially in the 22, and Jack had a change of heart. And I don't know whether the fact that I'd... I'm not sure. He never explained to me why. I never asked why. I was just happy to be there. But obviously, it wasn't until I was there and the lads, who I knew some of them in some way, and they sort of like told me the situation with Gary, which was terrible for him, but I just had to get on with the job in hand, really. And then I had the then I find out my room partner's Bernie Slaven, and that makes things an interesting 6 weeks away, because Bernie's quite unique, as you probably know, up there in the northeast. And that was an interesting maybe 5 or 6 weeks with Bernie, but it was great. So that was different. There were 5 substitutes in the 1990 World Cup. I somehow managed to get onto the bench. We'd played a game against Malta prior to the World Cup. After I had arrived into Malta, we played Malta in a friendly, and I was given my first appearance. Although it wasn't it was just my first appearance for Ireland, really. It was in a friendly. It wasn't a competitive game. And Frank Stapleton scored, I think he equaled the record or beat the record for goals for Ireland at that point in that game. And I played well in the game. I remember hitting the bar, getting around the pitch quite well. I was obviously confident after the playoff final. And I must have left a pressure on Jack. And I found myself, because Ronnie Whelan was injured, I ended up being sub against England. And like I said, 5 nominated. But then when it came to the World Cup in 94, I was lucky enough to score the equaliser in Northern Ireland to take us to the World Cup. But then when we arrived in the World Cup in 94, there was a slightly different dynamic, because everyone was sub. Whereas before there was four or five lads left out, now everyone's sub. And it was always quite amusing. I remember looking down the bench when Jack used to look round and, you know, he'd look round maybe trying to think, who shall I bring on? And you'd see all these little heads and pleading with him to put me on, please, you know, because everyone wants to play in the World Cup or make an appearance. And I obviously wanted to make an appearance in the 94 World Cup, but it was down to circumstance. It was down to, you know, how the game was going. There were a couple of boring games. I think the Norway game was pretty turgid in terms of each team knew a draw was quite sufficient, and it was going nowhere really. So there wasn't any changes there. And the Mexico game, when we played Mexico, John Aldridge came on and made a difference and scored. And again, that was the last substitution. So I think someone went off injured. So yeah, that was the main difference in terms of the actual tournaments themselves. Very hot in America. I mean, ridiculously hot down in Florida with a 3 o'clock kickoff against the Mexicans. You have not got a chance. And it would like being playing the Antarctic 11, you know, at 6:30 in the evening when the lights gone under floodlights, you'd have no chance. So that was a difficult game. But no, fantastic experience for me. 42 caps, all stemmed from, like I say, that, as you mentioned before, that confidence given to me by the opportunity by Lou Macari to give me the chance when I had been released by United, which I'll never forget. Then the belief that Ozzy put into me as a player to be able to play well consistently with a new formation. And then the rest of my career panned out from there, really. And I was so lucky to get to 35 and actually retired on my 35th birthday, actually. It was the last game of the season in 2000, I think it was. So that was my last game. It was for Rochdale against Bristol Rovers, and I managed to score. So it was a perfect ending, really. And that's how it finished.
I was going to say about the 94 World Cup, I imagine the sidelines was probably one of the most interesting places to be, when one of my memories of that is Jack Charlton and John Aldridge. I'm trying to think of how to put it, remonstrating with the officials, I think.
Charlie O'Leary was, and you know, Charlie's 98 now. He was our kit man at the time, and now I don't know whether Charlie had made a bit of a mess up with the fourth official's piece of paper for substitutes, because something went on, and next thing you know, I'm sitting actually in an air conditioned dugout, which was the highlight of the day, really. If you didn't get on, you were nice and cool, and when Jack asked you to warm up, you weren't too keen to go out there. But I saw the ensuing John Aldridge rant, and it's well documented. And then obviously Jack got himself in trouble. He got sent off, and then he missed the next game, and he had to pay a fine, which I'm sure he didn't pay, but the FAI did pay for him. So it was an incredible time. Unfortunately, my family could go out there, but my wife was pregnant at the time with my daughter Megan, so she never made it out there. So I was flying solo out in America, and it was. It would have been nice to have made an appearance out there, because you always want to, but at least I've made them two appearances in 1990. So it's like I said, I can't complain with my career. It was a lovely career, a great career over a long time. And I enjoyed all the battles with Sunderland, and particularly Borley kicking the absolute shin pods off of me on a yearly basis for many, many years. But the thing I liked about Borley was I was square with him and fair with him. No rolling around, no messing, no back chat. And I knew I was getting it every single game. And he didn't disappoint, to be fair. But I think he respected me as well, because I used to get up and just get on with the game and caused him problems and bits and bobs. So, no, special ground Roker. I liked it.
Yeah, still got to linger for Roker Park, but there you go. To the present day, you're now academy manager at Swindon Town, and you had worked at Portsmouth for a number of years alongside a couple of people you mentioned, Guy Whittingham and Paul Hardiman. So how did you end up back at Swindon in the role that you've got now?
Well, I got the sack from Portsmouth. That was as you can imagine, I wasn't very happy. But I've 13 years at Portsmouth as a player, as an academy coach. And then obviously Guy got the job, and he asked me eventually to go up and help him in the first team. And then Guy got the sack. I mean, the club was in the right state at that point. I mean, in two administrations, and it was all over the place. But I'm proud to say that, you know, even at that time, through administrations, we've managed to keep, and we kept the academy together at that point. And some fantastic sales have gone out the door since, the likes of Jed Wallace, Adam Webster at Brighton, Dan Butler at Peterborough, to name but a few. Ben Close now played over 100 games for Portsmouth. Jack Watmore plays at the back for Portsmouth now. He's had a couple of injuries in his career. Alex Bass, the goalie. There's a huge production line of players that we managed to get in because the club was in trouble and they went on to serve the club brilliantly. So my legacy, really, that's the one probably thing I'm really proud of, apart from playing as many games as I did for Pompey and really loving the place, is the fact that I managed to have, you know, work from a player right the way through to have 18 months in that first team environment. But we were saved, thankfully. The club was saved by the supporters. And, you know, a board was put in place. But it is quite difficult sometimes when supporters are running your club. They eventually see the other side of the other supporters. You know, they were taking the acclaim and high-fiving each other when things went brilliantly at the start, and quite rightly so. But then when you're 10 months in with no money and you've got substandard players and, you know, you've got no training ground to work with on, and things are starting to go the other way, and the fans, no matter how appreciative they are of what you've done, and they start naming and calling a few directors, they get a bit twitchy. And exactly what happened. And I'm quite straightforward and don't mess around, really, in terms of when I'm talking football, when I'm in a football environment. I'm not one to not mince my words or say what I feel. And unfortunately, it rubbed one or two people up the wrong way, I feel, in the end. And that was the end of me, and I left. I took a month off, but actually in the car back from Portsmouth, Jeremy Newton, who was the academy manager, had found out that I'd left, and he literally offered me the job to work at Swindon. That's where I live still. So I do live in Swindon. So it was an opportunity I couldn't turn down, really. I'd had 3 years at that point on the road travelling back and forth from Swindon to Portsmouth. So I decided to take the job on in the youth department, running the 12s to 16s. And then eventually I ended up being the under-18s manager for two seasons. And then the opportunity arose to become academy manager when the academy manager left, and the club offered me the role, and I couldn't say no. So, yeah, that's where I am currently. Unfortunately, through circumstance, I'm still furloughed, which is an absolute minefield. So since March, I've been off work and not been able to contribute, although the academy is back. So it's a bit of a strange situation, really, but I can't complain. I've just got to get my head down and wait for the opportunity to go back, hopefully on the 2nd of November, and get back in and start work again.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that in terms of the teams actually getting back into game. I mean, I imagine there's a lot of challenges in getting the young lads just back out onto the pitch. Is it the case that all of the age groups are back now, or is it only a certain amount of age groups?
No, all the age groups are back, but as you can imagine, Swindon are not in the best place financially, so we've had to take the club have taken stock on one or two of the coaches, and we've cut back on, and they've cut back on certain things, and certain things that were in place have been cut, and again, until I get back in and find the full extent of everything that's gone on, but there certainly has been some changes. But the good thing about the academy is we've produced players and sold players on last season. We managed to recoup in about 270 grand worth of player sales and income from other players that had signed for Premier League clubs, and there was some add-ons that came into the club. So the club benefited from about 270 grand worth of money into the club from the academy. So, you know, we're proud of that we can put players near the first team. It is difficult. Last year, the first team did exceptionally well, got promotion with Richie. This year might be a little bit more tougher because most of the main players that were the key figures last year, and the salary cap, et cetera, they've gone now. So things are going to be a little bit more difficult for Swindon Town and the academy. We've got the academy back, but we were late coming back compared to everyone else. And it's just cutting their cloth accordingly, really, the club in itself, and trying to save money where possible in different areas, like every club has got to do at the moment, because just there's no fans coming through the door and there's no cash flow. So, you know, everyone's got to pull the britches up and try and survive.
Yeah, and I think the academies at kind of clubs, you know, I mean, Sunderland as well. I mean, it's just going to become more and more important with the looks of the way how football's going to go. But when I was reading it up, it looked like, and I just hope I've got this right, it was up-to-date information, but Swindon have a Category 3 status.
Yeah,
I mean, that's correct. Right, under the Elite Players Performance Plan. There's clearly kind of planning an investment to maintain that category kind of level of status for teams like Swindon. But I mean, did does promotion in the way, you know, Swindon came up from League Two last season into League One, is there always a review of maybe trying to kind of progress that status, maybe even kind of move to category
absolutely two,
or was that just
no,
just too much investment?
Yeah, it's not even something that would even something I would bring up. It's something that's just too far beyond us. We do have planning permission for a new training ground. Now that the planning permission has been approved, whether that will end up coming to fruition is obviously down to the chairman and to investors or whoever might want to get involved in it. But at the moment, I can't see us as a football club ever, not say ever, but certainly in the next 5, 6, 7 years, being anything other than a Category 3 academy. You know, we train out of a secondary school. We train at the local college in the evenings. We hire pitches. We have to look around the town for sites for even, you know, futsal or an indoor venue. And everything's a bit of a bind and a struggle, but we've known nothing else. And I've known nothing else for the last 8 years, and that includes being at Portsmouth at the latter end of, like I said, when they were in financial difficulties and administration. That was the case then. So I've never been in a privileged position of being able to be at a football club who's actually in a position where, in academy world, are stable. So every day is a battle. Every day is a fight. Every year, like I said, our objectives are to try and produce our own players, which we do. The production line's been good, but also there's a level of responsibility to move players on to gain some income into the club, and that's something we've managed to do successfully over the past 5 or 6 years. You know, I can name Jaden Bogle is one player that we had who moved on. Jaden Mitchell Lawson, who's now currently on loan at Bristol Rovers, and there's various boys that have, particularly Chelsea, have been quite proactive with us and taken players. Scott Twine, who's playing for Newport currently, is one of our players in terms of he's on loan there. Scored a cracking goal the other night for Newport against Cambridge. He's a youth player that's come through, and we hope that he will progress to the first team at some point, maybe next season, in terms of and he finds himself in a similar position as I do at the similar age, where he's got to go out and toughen up in League Two and get himself mentally and physically ready to come back and give it a right go at Swindon next season. So yeah, that's our aim, and we tick off one day at a time, really, and we enjoy it, and you just get used to it.
Yeah, kind of one of the reasons I asked that, because there's been quite a lot of discussion with Sunderland fans over the last couple of seasons, because when we came down to League One, we've stuck with being a Category One academy in League One, which is obviously, you know, slightly strange, I suppose, in the kind of historical sense that not many clubs have had that status down in League One, if any at all. But from your point of view, as seeing, you know, the Swindon Town Academy, I mean, is it a no-brainer from an outsider looking in that Sunderland would stick with a Category One status as long as you've got those funds to support it rather than cutting back?
Well, they have the advantage down. They have their own training ground, so there's no expenditure like we end up doing, spending out a hell of a lot of money on facilities that are not ours. So they have that. They've already got their protocols in place. The facilities are correct and tick a box, which allow the funding to come in. It's how the club then manage that funding when it comes in, because I'm 99% sure that's not ring-fenced for the academy, as it's not ring-fenced at any football club. So when that money comes into the football club from the EFL, if you're Category 1, I don't know the exact figure, but certainly at Category 3 level, it's around 400 grand just over that comes in. So everything has to be paid out from that, staffing to every amenity, every, you know, expenditure goes out the door. And if the club overshoots that at academy level, then obviously the club are paying that themselves. So, like I said, if that money's coming in and Sunderland are using it in different areas, for example, then that becomes very difficult for it to maintain its status as a Category 1 club further down the line. Because obviously, like I said, I don't know the ins and outs of it, and I wouldn't claim to, but the longer you're down there, the harder that's going to be, unless you've got a sugar daddy who's quite prepared to pay for this. But at some point, this academy has got to, at Sunderland, start shelving players out onto the football pitch, or the club have got to make a decision that we need to start playing players from our academy. And, you know, I'm sure there's enough quality there, but managers sometimes find it very difficult to go and throw academy players in there, because obviously they know they've got a short shelf life themselves and got a job to do to get the team promoted. So it's a really, really tough one in terms of the right thing to do at the right time. Success breeds success, and sometimes academy players don't get anywhere near it. But like I said, when we was in adversity at Portsmouth, the club had no choice other than throwing these kids in and giving them opportunities. And that ended up being a lifeblood for the club further down the line when, you know, Adam Webster gets sold for 750 grand, Jed Wallace money, other players, Dan Butler out the door, Ben Close playing over, like I said, 100 games for Portsmouth. And that's saving huge money because you're not buying another player to take his place. So there's lots of investment and lots of players that have played. Alex Bass now, who's a young goalkeeper, who I think there was some interest from Crystal Palace for him. So these players are in and around it, and it's saving the club money. So you'd like to think it works. It doesn't always. So are Sunderland still Category 1 even now? Yeah. They're still there now. Well, that's fair play to them, because that takes some doing. Whether they can sustain that is another thing. And I think it's such a big year this year that we do get crowds back in the door. And it's a big year for Sunderland in terms of, as always, trying to get promoted. They're such a big club in terms of their stature in the game. But it doesn't give you the divine right, as Portsmouth, we found out in Division 2, the old Division 4, rattling around there for a few years with no money, no training ground, substandard players, players that had been released by everyone else and end up at your door and, you know, think they're better than they are. And that's the problem you find as well, the further you are down. The leagues that these players have got ideas above their station, they think they're playing for a big club, they're equally as good players, and you'll generally find out they're not. They're substandard. Yeah. So, but it is what it is, and agents play a big part in persuading clubs that their client has three or four clubs after them. People get worried that, you know, and they end up signing players that are not the right ones or not the ones who can sustain it for a period of 50, 60 games in a season, and players that have got the minerals to, when things are turning against them, to not suddenly have a calf injury or a groin strain or a hamstring injury. They're staying out there playing when they're getting a bit of stick from the Sunderland fans or the Portsmouth fans or the Swindon fans, because your team's not doing great. And the character of players nowadays, it needs a lot of work.
Yeah, and just one other criticism I think that Sunderland fans have at kind of our younger players and our kind of academy system over the last few years has been that I don't think we've sent enough players out on loan to get that experience. We had last season, Jack Diamond went to Harrogate Town and had a fantastic year, and he's come back almost a different player. You know, you can see he's almost come back a man, and he's ready for first team football. I mean, how do you get that balance right between trying to nurture players within the academy and trying to get them out on loan to get that first team experience?
Well, it's a bit of a shock for players who've been used to such a fantastic environment, as you suggested, as Sunderland's Category 1 academy is. Perfect pitches, I'd imagine. They get their meals every, you know, breakfast, dinner. They've got every amenity available to them. And then suddenly, you know, they do progress and the club sees value in the players and they're taken on as pros. But as all the coaches will know in there, they're trying their best trying to get these players physically and, more importantly, mentally ready to take on the step of playing out in the Stadium of Light. Listen, I've played there. I played at Roker. You know, you go out there and the hairs on the back of your neck stand up. And I played at Fratton Park, 18,000, and the expectation, the weight of expectation, they're not experiencing it enough. Under 23 leagues, I've watched that. It's tippy-tappy, pretty football. But when you get into proper men's leagues in and around the Northeast or anywhere else in the country where you've got 29, 30-year-olds who are working and then playing in the evenings, you know, these lads have been through the systems in, you know, at clubs before. They've probably been at Sunderland as kids. They've grown up, they're men, and they're playing against you. And then these kids are sent from this lovely environment to, you know, right in your face, no messing around environment. There's not much playing out from the back. There's not much playing through the lines. It's get it forward, get around it and get stuck in. And that's the element of the boy you've mentioned there has probably managed to cope with that, because mentally he's probably quite tough, and he probably has been for a long time. And that's, I found the biggest thing in the players I've had to deal with over the last 8 years in the academy and youth development, etc. It's the mentality of the players now. I don't like saying it because I'm an academy manager of Swindon, but players are soft now. The whole environment is soft. Coaches are not allowed to be direct as they really want to be. to get the best for these lads and give them their knowledge and experience about what life's about playing. You have to earn the right to play. You have to earn the respect of other people around you to play at the top level. And you have to do it week in, week out. And like I said, I mean, I've rolled into, for example, Arsenal's car park for their under-18s. My God, I mean, I've never seen, you know, I've not had a car like that for 20 years. But this is where it's going. You know, my main aim as a player was to make my league debut. That's all it was about. Make my league debut. Say I've made it and done it. Now it's about, well, what car can I get first and da-da-ya. So that's the environment that's changed. That's why sometimes it's hard to get players through because they're not mentally right. But I'm sure Sunderland battle the same sort of battles we do, no matter what your category, one, two or three, that you're trying to find the right players with the right mental state to be able to cope with going to maybe a non-league ground. I mean, I don't know, Blyth, Harrogate, something like that. I don't know, somebody and something different out of their comfort zone. And it's the one that can cope with that, inevitably, are the ones that come back to Sunderland or any club and manage to force their way nearer the first team than other players. So, but that's hard to create that environment in a Category 1 environment, if that makes sense, because it has to work in a certain way. Whereas in a Category 3 where I am, it's still a bit rough and ready, but we've still got a soft underbelly of a situation. So, but it's quite difficult. And we also find that sometimes some of the boys that come later into the academy haven't been there since they were 8 and 9. The boys that arrive into academy later on, maybe 13 or 14, are generally the boys who have played soccer with their mates and played local football and then get picked up at a later age. They're the boys that have gone on and made scholarships and made pro contracts because they've had that element of not as much pressure for 6 or 7 years. They've just played with their mates and they've enjoyed it rather than being under constant scrutiny from 9 and having reviews. And, you know, I know it sounds like there's a lot wrong with the system. There's a lot right with it in academy world, but there's a lot wrong with it. And I personally think that to make a journey from the 9, you know, like, for example, Scott Twine, who I mentioned is one of our academy boys who's now getting experience at Newport and scoring goals. He's made that journey since he's 9. And that's a long journey. I mean, he's only 20. I mean, that's 11, 12 years, you know, under scrutiny every week. And that must be difficult for the players as well. And lots of them fall out of love with the game. And the ones who have the mental strength inevitably have the character, maybe not as technically good as other players, not as naturally gifted, but the ones with the mental strength are the core mental strength are the ones that generally will make it further forward than anyone else moving forward in category either category 1, 2 or 3s.
It's funny you should say that. I think Sunderland fans got a big shock. We played Aston Villa under 23s in the EFL Trophy, won 8-1.
Yeah,
and it was just it was men against boys, and although you could tell that kind of a very young Aston Villa side, but they were technically very good. I don't think they won a header all night or won a tackle or looked like they wanted to win a tackle. And it was, yeah.
Because they're not used to it, and it's not their fault. It's just the way things have been set up, and it's the way that the Premier League have their format. And I mean, as you can watch a Premier League game now, you know, the keeper has it, he plays out, they come forward, teams drop off. And it's, you know, it's quite laboured, quite slow. You're waiting for it to get into the last third of the pitch before you actually take a bit of an interest because, you know, that's the way the game's gone now. And that's the way it is at, you know, 21s, 23s football. You go and watch it and it's not real football in terms of most of these lads then struggle after, say, for example, you've been released by Aston Villa under 23s. Most of them are going to struggle to find a way in football because you can't then go, you know, play for Tamworth, you know, unless you're mentally fine and up for it and up for the challenge, then it's going to be a very difficult job because the lads at Tamworth have been out of the game quite a while and they're physically ready to take on the challenge week in, week out, have a job and work and play football. And the lads really struggle. And that is unfortunately, there's some brilliance that's come out of the academies. Don't get me wrong, there's some being fantastic players. But also there's lots of players who've fallen by the wayside and then can't find their way back into the game. Whereas when I certainly left United, I still, you know, I had plenty of opportunities as long as I was perform okay to get back into the game because we were all mentally strong enough in the main to deal with going and playing men's football. I mean, when I was at Man United as a kid, we used to play South Liverpool. Men's team are under, you know, you're talking under 16s up to under 18s. In our league was South Liverpool. That was a Tuesday night in Liverpool against grown men, and you were 16 to 18. I mean, that was just, I mean, I think about it now, I wouldn't even dare send my, you know, any lads from Man United to South Liverpool on a Tuesday night. But, you know, Eric Harrison, the coach at United, he loved it. He said, this is where you make your living. This is where I can see who's got the minerals to go out there and play against 33-year-olds who are scousers against little Man United players. And you soon learn to step away, check your shoulder, see the tackle coming, see the flailing arm coming, and you soon learn quickly. And that's what's missing. Yeah. But, you know, the game's moved on. And I don't want to sound and harp on like some old ex-pro who's bitter about things. I'm not, because I'm in it, and I'm trying to educate our academy lads to be stronger, tougher mentally, and make them understand. And parents, you know, that's half the battle as well. But yeah, that was then. This is now. Things move on. But I certainly hope that the likes of Sunderland can find their way back somehow into a strong position, as I hope Portsmouth do well and Swindon do well moving forward. So they're the teams I look out for.
Well, Eric Harrison didn't, he brought one or two on, so he had a good
record.
Yeah,
he didn't do bad. He didn't do bad, to be fair. And it wasn't just the famous boys that he had a bit later down the line. There were some good players that went on and made careers.
So that Saturday's game, so obviously last season, fantastic achievement, especially, you know, under the circumstances, still won the league, points per game. Fantastic achievement after finishing 13th the season before. This season in League One, being 2 wins and 3 defeats so far for Richie Welland's team. Have the results reflected the game so far, or have Swindon kind of been unfortunate to come away with 3 defeats?
Well, I watched the game on Saturday. I watched it through the iPlayer scenario, and I didn't think they... I mean, possession-wise, they do keep the ball well. But they were, you know, lacked a little bit. In the last third of the pitch, they weren't as strong as they were last season. Yeah, they're just finding it tough at the moment in terms of that consistency. That their patterns of play, which you'll see at the weekend, are good. That they are confident on the ball. It's whether they're strong enough up front and defensively to hurt teams through the season. I think it's important that I'd be very surprised. I'd be quite surprised if they're up and around it at the end of the season, if the current situation stays as it is with the fact of limited funds to get any other players in, etc. I don't think we're anywhere near the cap, the salary cap, in terms of what the club is in a position to offer players. So subsequently, when you lose Owen Doyle, as we did at the end of the season, couldn't afford to keep him on, etc. Jerry Yates went on from us and Rotherham onto Blackpool. So when you're missing players like that, Zeki Fryers is currently, I think he's injured at the minute. Paul Caddis is struggling as well, I think for the weekend. Who's an experienced, good player. So it's going to make it an interesting game. So I'm sure their confidence is not great at the minute because they just haven't managed to be consistent enough both up front and particularly at the back. So it'll be interesting to see how it goes. I'm hoping obviously they win because obviously it keeps them up there. And the first and most important thing, and it's obvious that they need to get enough points to be in the division. Richie Wellens did a fantastic job last year, and I think he's probably a little bit frustrated this year with how things have gone. He signed players, the club have brought players in as well, and yeah, they're not quite at the standard that they were last year. And I think overall, you know, if he manages to get them into the playoff positions this year, he'll have done a fantastic job. So it'll be interesting to see how the rest of the season pans out. I certainly don't think we're as strong as last year in terms of our overall group. So it's going to take a lot of work on the training ground to get this particular group up to speed. And particularly when you take away Owen Doyle's goals from last year and the amount of goals and Yates' contribution as well in goals. And we also lost Lloyd Isgrove. He didn't sign a contract. And I think it was Kane Woolley went off to Tranmere. So there's four forward players that haven't really will be tough to replace, and they had a bit of experience as well. So yeah, it'd be difficult. We have to rely on the loan market as well. And Richie's got his work cut out a lot more this year than certainly last year. Last year he was, you know, things were great, and the fans and returned to the County Ground, really saw some fantastic football at times, and they were a little bit spoilt, really. So I think they're just going to have to bed down and accept that this year, with a lot of graft, might be okay, but it's going to be, I think, a long season where the expectations just need to be dampened down a little bit. But if like I said, they get into the playoffs, it'll be an absolutely huge achievement.
That would be incredible if they do that two seasons in a row. And I saw, looking at the game so far as well, I saw Johnny Smith has weighed in with a couple of goals from midfield. But so who are the players do you think could cause Sunderland problems on Saturday?
I'll be honest, I've not been allowed to go to the ground. So I've not really seen too much apart from watching it on the EFL. So yeah. You're probably telling me. Johnny Smith looks a direct player. He scored a couple of decent goals. I watched the game for the first time on Saturday, like I said, live through the TV. And like I said, it wasn't great, but it was okay. No one's really standing out at the moment who's you know, who you think, well, you know, you need to be really wary of him. But certainly they've got a little bit of work to do, like I said. And if I'd watched them a little bit more this season and had the opportunity to get into the ground, which I'm not allowed into the ground, by the way, to watch a game, then I'd be in a bit a better position to give you a little bit more feedback. So at the minute, I'm really seeing what you're seeing. So it's a mixed bag of hot and cold. They could turn up and really turn it on, or it could be Sunderland's day and, you know, nice and comfortably. I don't think there'll be a middle ground, if that makes sense.
That's pretty much been Sunderland. We're unbeaten so far, but I wouldn't say we've kind of hit the ground running this season. We've been kind of grinding the results away.
Yeah, but I certainly think Sunderland need to be careful. They need to be careful because if they get the passing game going and the movement patterns right, they can cause lots of teams lots of problems. So they just need to be careful, Sunderland, in how they approach it. I mean, at the moment, you'd say they were favourites to win the game. But like I said, it's a funny old game. We've all seen the ups and downs of it. Like you said, as you mentioned earlier on, us arriving at Roker Park all those years ago, expecting to win and end up getting beat 4-1. So you just got to be very careful. And I'm not good at predicting results and fixtures and games. That's, unfortunately, that's never been my strong point.
It's a fascinating game on Saturday. So let's hope it's a good game for all concerned. It's just a shame we have to watch on through the screens rather than actually being there. But on that note, Alan, I'd just like to say thank you so much. It's been absolutely fascinating and I really appreciate you taking the time out for us.
No, I really enjoyed it. Love talking about football. You know, like I said, fond memories of playing at Sunderland many, many times, getting some good results, bad results. Like I said, Bawley kicking me around the park, which is always something to be mindful of. And obviously we shared a great moment, certainly for me personally, at Wembley. So Sunderland will always play some part in my life because I have to talk about them because I scored against them, albeit via deflection, to win the playoff final. So, thank you very much. I enjoyed it and do it again sometime.
Sounds good. And all the very best of the season. I hope to see you on a training ground or the side of a pitch very soon.
That would be nice. Roll on November the 2nd. That would be nice. Thank you.
Good stuff.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.